My name is Diana, and this is the Family Finance Show, the podcast to help you manage your family's finances better. Every week, we share an episode on topics relating to increasing your family's income and managing expenses, controlling your debt, and investing for the future. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Family Finance Show, where we try to help families make better financial decisions. Today, I've got as a guest on the show, Alex, who is a family man and has agreed very kindly to come on the show and share a bit about his experiences with his own family finance. So welcome to the show, Alex. And maybe you can start by telling the listeners and myself a bit about your family.
Thanks, Diane, and that's nice to be on the show. So the family, I mean, what you'd sort of typically above average working class. So business degree on my side, I've done the typical corporate career, lucky enough to hold a couple of middle management positions. My wife did the same until we decided to start a family. And given her skill set of creative services, she managed to leave her corporate job, and she effectively managed to contract back working the same job from home while doing the majority of the parenting, basically, in addition to obviously pulling in the work. So like most women, typically two jobs, not one. We've managed to hold that model for over a decade. She's been able to expand it to several clients, not just the original corporate one. Two kids, one 9 years old, one 12 years old, both in private schools, which of course has its own financial ramifications. That's sort of a top line summary.
And I think a family setup that a lot of people can relate to. What about where you live? So I know that you recently moved cities, and I find, especially after this pandemic, people have adjusted their work lives and their home lives so much, and people are moving to other cities in the same country, or maybe even moving countries. I don't know. I've actually lost count of the number of farewells I've gone to, either people moving city or people moving country. So you guys did that. You moved your family from one city to another. What was that experience like, both from the costs involved in moving point of view, but also just on family life? How was it to move from one place to another?
There's a lot of things that you think you've anticipated if you're doing the city move within the same country. And surprise, surprise, semigration is still complicated, even if you're doing it from what are the relative safe familiar confines of Joburg down to Cape Town. Some of the all the unexpected things really come down to the logistics, right? So in terms of my experience, I mean, to trace it back to the beginning, let's just start with selling the property, because effectively the experience we had from a Joburg perspective, property in Joburg, it's a bit of a crapshoot depending on where you're trying to sell and the kind of agents that you deal with, etc. If you're trying to break even or make some money, you're either lucky or you've bought a very long time ago at a bargain price. At least that's sort of my high level observation. Or maybe I'm just not so good at this property stuff. we just about broke even after handling commissions, rates clearances, electrical compliance certificates, electrical fence certificates, which don't see a lot of the stuff is not necessarily all well communicated at all to homeowners. So if you're a homeowner and you haven't kept sort of pace with this stuff, just be very clear on sort of your obligations on that, because that's important. Be careful about trusting your family's mate or your, you know, or their preferred electrician, a person genuinely shop around. We got quite lucky with the sale as a whole, because we sold much, much quicker than we thought. What we then did with that luck, we decided to complicate it further by diving into the idea of building a new home in our new spot instead of just finding one to buy. Now, look, that's not a flawed plan in the sense that, you know, if one sort of looked at the details, Cape Town's got a large number of really good developments where you're obviously avoiding transfer costs, which can help massively, right? Depending on, especially in the kind of size home, if you think about what a normal, in inverted commas, family of four is looking to buy, you can save a decent chunk of change from a transfer cost perspective. We didn't anticipate little things though. So I think one of the key things, especially if you're a family and you've got kids, try and choose, don't choose, we almost chose the suburb before choosing the school. It's really important to maybe do it the other way around. Mm. We ended up we just got super lucky because we ended up 5 minutes away from the school we liked anyway. We also lucked out in choosing to rent instead of buy, which was the initial sort of construct of that was have somewhere to live while the house is being built. Mm. But actually, it just turned out to be super helpful to get us acclimated to the area, the lifestyle, etc. But of course, rent comes with issues, especially if you're not familiar. 2 months deposit, one month rent up front. A lack of negotiation leverage because demand is so high. So we ended up swallowing 1 month of rent paid when we weren't even in the unit yet because we really needed to secure something.
Did you find the unit while you were still in Johannesburg, or did you have to make a trip down to Cape Town with your family, which would have involved some expense to go and look at different houses? How did you find the place to rent?
I don't recommend this. We rented a little blind. Yeah. But luckily the internet is of the age where you can actually get away with this. And generally I find that as long as you're dealing with a really good responsive agent, you can get away with this. The thing is that it's weird. It depends on who you are and how you choose to make decisions. Mm-hmm. We broadly knew we needed something quite economical in space and just something that could sort of mobilize us fairly close to the suburb that we ultimately ended up choosing. A lot of sites, which just a bizarre thing, rental listings tend to disappear really quickly online. At least that's the experience in Cape Town. Case in point, I've recently shopped around the unit now to get new tenants coming in to replace me. Mm. We had one show day, one show morning. That's it. It's already done. Wow. It's that quick.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it again, I guess a lot of it depends on where you are and how you are. That might be, if I had a bit more sort of spare cash, I probably would look to buy one of these things and rent it out from an income perspective. So, but yeah, we to answer your question, I mean, we pretty much shopped around from distance. I did manage to get down here to investigate it, and that obviously became an important piece of the experience. What was interesting about the spot we chose, you don't necessarily plan for the sort of getting a good sense of the size of the place. So when I got down here, I realized on a pre-scouting trip a month before the big move, okay, this place is a bit small. We need to start
selling sort furniture.
And it's surprisingly hard to offload your old stuff. My advice, mm-hmm. don't wait until the last minute. It takes much longer than you think unless you're just dumping everything. Mm-hmm. But luckily we managed to do it. And I think in a strange way, it was quite a good exercise as a mental shift of just recognizing just sort of how much space you can waste or superfluous stuff you can accumulate. And it really just, you know, I think to a point, space can be almost a little bit overrated if you're just sort mm-hmm. of not optimizing its usage, if mm. that makes sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really like a minimalist lifestyle too much, to as great an extent as possible. And I find, because we moved into our house from a 1.5-bedroom flat, and we moved into a 3-bedroom house. And we just slowly expanded our stuff to fill the space. We started with nothing, not even a dining room table. We ate at the kitchen counter for a long time. And yeah, I find as well, the more space you have, the more stuff fills it. So yeah, if you had to downsize, I guess it was quite tricky. But as you said, it just frees you up to a certain extent. And, you know, you really have to decide what is important to you and what you really need in your house.
Yeah, it's something which we then very much lingered into keeping the theme of that as we sort of adjusted to the city. I'll quickly close off one point because it does link back to sort of the financial structure. We ultimately, the irony is that we ended up abandoning the build. Because even though we went plot and plan, and despite the protections that the Consumer Protection Act speaks to, it's actually quite exposed on in terms of how it protects you with property. It doesn't protect you all that much. So, recommendation, please don't build without a lawyer. Don't build without a full blow-by-blow account of every cost that could be incurred. I have scars from the mistakes, but they taught me lots. Luckily, didn't cost me too much in the end, and they managed to recover all the money from the sale of the land, which luckily seems to move really, really quickly here. In that respect, but I think when you come to come back to the downsizing, I think that that was some of the interesting elements that we picked up in the practical nature of settling into the city, because you suddenly realize, you know, and this kind of all sounds obvious, but only when you're in it do you suddenly realize and recognize just how fundamentally important it becomes in terms of how you sort of adjust to a new lifestyle, because you shop differently, you drive differently, your emotions and mental energies are different. So here in Cape Town, by comparison to Joburg, we can be sort of claustrophobic in certain respects. Feeling inspired by the outdoors, so you gym more and you eat healthier. Gym here was cheaper, weirdly though. You focus hard on savings programs like Vitality and extra savings to get every cent into your back pocket. You ensure you have enough Discovery miles to pay for flights, even when Comair has repeated issues like they're currently going through now. You reevaluate medical aid. You're talking about downsizing. I cannot, you know, in the process of, because I this immigration involved a change in job as well, and it's so weird to sort of I'd never been off. This is a first world problem, clearly, but off Discovery proper before, and you suddenly sort of recognize just sort of the dynamics and about how much medical aid. I realized that we were always paying for the medical savings account. So what's really the difference in changing certain plans? Which sounds like a very ignorant statement, but until it becomes an opportunity for you to examine it, you don't do so. And that's why moving, in a sense, forces you to reset everything and ask yourself if you need all the stuff that you're originally paying for.
I love that. I really love that. And what did you decide for the medical aid savings? So have you got a now? Have you got a plan without the medical aid savings, or what did you choose in terms of your medical aid?
So we tested it. We said, look, we were fortunate enough to build up a decent nest egg of emergency funds. And I mean, I would think most people would reasonably say medical expenses or emergencies. There were a couple of other sort of inherent regular things which we felt that we could finance accordingly. We said, okay, let's do the experiment. Let's take a year off or with a plan that doesn't have anything like the medical savings coverage. And I think what's been interesting is, even though we, so on one hand you notice it more because, you know, you're paying a lot more out of your pocket than you used to, because so it's no longer, you know, co-payment or medical aid covered X medicine at the counter. You're now sort of paying for it. But then I always trace it back and ask the question, when this was coming off your account, you had to pay a lot more in terms of, you know, sort of your deductions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. I personally do not like medical aid savings accounts because they force you to save where you can't use the savings for something else. So it depends on how disciplined a saver you are. But let's say I've saved 12,000 rand in my medical aid savings account and I change jobs and I have to change medical aid. I can't recover that savings often. I mean, it depends on the rules of the specific medical aid. So I can't really speak generally here, but my experience is that the saving component, it doesn't actually save you anything, but you do need to have the money available to pay the co-payments and whatever shortfalls there are. So you need to have that saved up. But if you've got that emergency fund, I feel like a medical aid savings account is so inflexible. What if your emergency is actually your car's brakes need replacing, and then you can redirect the emergency fund there instead? So that's my view, but everyone has got different situations, especially with medical aid. So it's hard to give a blanket answer there. But to go back to your house quickly, if you don't mind, Alex. So am I correct in that you paid off your house in Johannesburg, and are you renting in Cape Town now, or have you decided to purchase and are you getting a bond?
So we are indeed going to purchase or have purchased, and we did, and you're quite right. So what happened is we managed to absolutely destroy the bond in Joburg in 10 years. So thank you, corporate jobs and saving money.
Well done. So that's not easy.
Agreed. So our liquidity was in great shape, relatively speaking, and we managed to sort of use the proceeds of the sale of that house to throw at the new one. And something you also fundamentally realize is that, you know, when you're buying a house, you know, think about whether you really will stay in there the whole term of the loan. Because in Joburg, you know, and then granted, I mean, plans change obviously for a family, but we thought we'd be there our whole lives. But that inherently was a flawed thought, because and almost to the point where now we've approached our purchase in Cape Town knowing full well we're very likely to leave before that term is up. So in a sense, look at the loan as a way to pay rental rands that give you equity that you take with you when you sell up again. The main thing we targeted really with this new bond was to make sure we could still get the bond repayment to no more than 25% of my net income, and then specifically mine by itself. We thought that was quite a critical maximum number to hit, because that way any money my wife brings in is total bonus, and you know, you're still sort of doing something broadly financially responsible as well.
Yeah, and if you take that conservative approach, you've got a lot of room to play. If interest rates go up, like everyone in the financial media says they are going to go up, if you've maxed out your bond, if you've taken the maximum possible, often your monthly expenses can't absorb an interest rate increase. So, yeah, it's awesome that you are in that position to make a decision like that. When you were looking at houses and you were trying to, you said, okay, we have a budget of X for a house. Did you already work out, okay, we don't want to pay, we've got this deposit and we don't want to pay more than 25% of our of your net income? Did you go with that in mind, like this is the budget that we've got to spend on the house, or did you just find a house that you liked and say, okay, we can afford it?
House shopping is very difficult and very emotional.
Yeah.
And when you add in all sorts of other dynamics, like because you always feel FOMO, you always feel a tension to negotiate, you always feel a tension to get the most value, there's lots of different tensions. Ironically, we ended up buying a place that sort of incurred a transfer fee anyway, or transfer duties anyway, but we still managed to, I mean, at the end of the day, the number needs to be important. We also sort of thought very much around the resale movement in the area, the extent to which, you know, again, to come back to the previous point around what happens in 5-10 years, is this going to struggle to move around? Because you've also got to think about the kind of market that who's going to buy your house. And I know that's a strange thing to ask, but think about it from the perspective of, if someone who's not in a similar bracket to you is not going to be interested in your house from a financial perspective, then you may need to reconsider even buying it, because then you're going to struggle. Whereas, you know, in terms of where we are, where we looked at it, we very much felt that, cool, this has got a salient value that we can probably bank on in being able to shift. And that doesn't, I mean, if it shifts for more, that's ideal. But even if it shifted for the same, we were fundamentally also looking at, you know, our financial needs are not going to be the same in 10 years time or 15 years time, when sort of the kids have decided that they're tired of the parents and they want to move out and start their own thing. So,
which is what normally happens. So you can probably bank on that happening to you as well.
Exactly. So in the other dynamic as well is, of course, I mean, to a large extent, because of my age, I'm sort of entering close to what I would hope, please God, is the peak earning. So that peak earning period just sort of also naturally gives certain room. So even though in a sense this is the most expensive bond I've had, it's also the best place I've ever been to afford. And as long as, again, I'm keeping it within the parameters, I'm comfortable.
So Alex, it sounds like your family finances are pretty much in good shape. So you've got a very affordable bond. It's only 25% of your net income. You've got an emergency fund, which is great. I mean, most people struggle to get to that point because debt really holds them back. So most people are paying off personal loans or credit card debt, but it seems like you're in a pretty good place. But you must have made some mistakes along the way. Can you share with our listeners some of the worst financial mistakes you've made in your 40 years on Earth or thereabouts?
Too many to count. But the main ones for me would be sort of four succinct sort of thoughts. The first one is I reckon I was just way too risk averse when I was young. To his credit, my dad put me in front of a financial advisor almost immediately after getting my first job. But I wasn't really properly educated on investing, financial fitness, compound interest, etc. So I just ended up being scared to death of losing a penny, and it affected every decision I made with saving and investing until very recently. I only entered the stock market properly in my late 30s via a great financial advisor, a tax-free savings account, and my own adventures, some of them misadventures on easy equities. But this is at least 15 years too late, right? So you can have money and knowledge, and that can help to a point, but you can never get the years back. So time and market over time in the market every single day. Mm-hmm. Second one, old school teachings are not everything, because, you know, for example, I know someone who took an early bonus in his late 20s and threw it at Apple, all at Apple shares in the early 2000s. Just imagine what that is for a second. Mm-hmm. Now, I could have easily done that, because I also received bonuses in those years. But instead, I was schooled constantly to throw it at the bond, throw it at the bond. The interest, it's a killer, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not to contradict my earlier points, but I'm just thinking that, you know, I suspect having a few hundred shares of Apple 10 years later may have been far more useful in the long term than a cheaper bond in a house that only broke even. So I think when you sort of look at those economics, and maybe that's just a isolated example of real estate, but it also illustrates the power of the stock market, let's be honest. Mm. Impatient, third one would be very impatient, impulsive over big purchases. I mentioned the house building thing. Mm. Very stupid, very stressed. I needed to make peace with rental as a vehicle to discover a place instead of feeling pressure to make an immediate shift sort of work. I didn't know what I was doing there, and fundamentally what I needed to do is just sort of step back and say, a lot of people get very scared of rental, and mm-hmm. because of the idea that you're sort of paying off to someone else's bond effectively. There is an elegance to the flexibility there, so rather take it because it's quite valuable. And then last thing, this is actually probably the one that I'm working on the most right now, which is never underestimate the importance of a side hustle, because corporate jobs are very dangerous. They make you lazy. Mm. I didn't feel enough tension to find new things until my wife's business was annihilated by COVID. She's only started getting it back on her feet recently. And this forced both of us to relook everything. And you can only cut costs so much. So, I mean, the top line is much more important. And as I look up to all these MBA graduates, I tend to find just as much admiration in the business owners have achieved genuine financial liberty with a growing a business rather than just, you know, lots of badges on a CV. Not that MBA graduates are bad. They're awesome. But you also need to look at people who really own businesses.
Cool. I love those 5 points. I think it's great advice to rent instead of buy when you move to a new area. I think it's so important because you might regret your decision. You might not realize you don't want to live in the city. And to have to sell a house, living in it for less than 7 years, costs you really a lot of money. So I love that point. And the first point you made around starting early, I think that's so key. I recently read an old article by Morgan Housel. I don't know if you know him, Alex.
I don't.
He wrote a great book called The Psychology of Money, and he has a blog at the Collaborative Fund. Listeners can Google him. It's Housel, Sousel. And he wrote this article called The Freakishly Strong Base. It's a wonderful explanation of compound growth using, he starts off describing the ice age and how ice built up over time. And he uses it to describe compound growth in a really fascinating way. Time in the market, over timing the market, I couldn't agree with you more. So those are some great, great points for our listeners. And maybe just to end off, can you maybe tell us a bit about your future financial goals?
So we only really started getting financially fit, I guess, in our 40s because our proper education was recent, which sucks, to be honest. But you can only play the card you're dealt with, right? So as a result, I think, and this is important sort of considerations for anyone in the, sort of discovers this late. So I'm not, I mean, we're not going to do unrealistic things like retire at 55 or stuff like that because we just don't have the runway. And besides, in any case, I'm super restless. I'm trying to live as many years as I can. So our goals are to ensure we don't outlive our money, and that we don't burden my kids with having to look after us. So it's really about the tactical things. Immediate thing, get our kids through schooling so we've got that. We intend to do that through annual payments for the discount as much as we can get away with it. We intend to maximize our tax-free savings account as much as we can, because in a strange way, their limitations still give you something that you can work with. And even though we started later, it sucks, but I've already worked out, I have still 17 years to reach my lifetime limit if I'm investing the maximum possible. But so I still have time, and actually I'm planning on working longer than that. Same with my wife. And by the way, if you're younger, you can afford to put less away as compound interest, blah blah. So that obviously helps. We also intend to save it for experiences. So, I'm a firm believer that family holidays are the true signals of life's best pleasures for family memories. So we've decided to literally cost our dream trips and set up savings goals for those trips. Two observations. One, the trip may be cheaper than you think it is. And then also, at the end of the day, just sort of start the runway. It may take 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it is, but that's the plan. Save up to sort of start putting it off. And then lastly, and this is sort of the big thing, we intended to sort of try and see how we can future-proof the income. So side hustles. First, money while we sleep. So my wife is writing a book. I'm exploring ideas for a content play. We're selling digital planners and parenting aids on Etsy. We're looking at other avenues. Then we're also looking forward around sort of money, for our time. Like, what skills do I need to be employable at 60? Must I code, learn more about cloud, be able to offer critical expertise on user experience or some other thing that happens in 20 years? Oddly enough, I already ticked off one of those boxes that I mentioned. More to come. Never stop learning, never stop earning, never stop living. It's just sort of that's the gist of it.
Cool. I love that plan. I love it. And I especially love the holidays. I also think it's an important part of family life and one of the most valuable things you can do with your money. So very, very cool plans that you've got. And thanks so much, Alex, for sharing all your personal family finances with listeners. I hope that they've found something useful. Maybe they've made similar mistakes to you, and hopefully, if they're listening and haven't made those mistakes, they can avoid these mistakes by understanding them, like understanding what they did for you. So thank you so much for coming on the show tonight and for sharing so freely of your time.
Thank you, Dana. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast to stay on the journey to improving your family's financial well-being.